Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, joined here in our very fancy modern studio by Tom Nichols, who, how should we introduce you? The author of The Death of Expertise. You are
that
an esteemed
works.
Academic, but you do not speak for the Navy.
I do not speak for the U.S. government in any way, shape, or form.
But right. You're not furloughed, right? Or are you?
No,
right?
We were part of the group that's, we were funded. We're one of the departments that's still funded at this point, but.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. Although, who knows how long this will last. Maybe a year from now, it'll be different.
Well, I don't think we're headed toward a compromise. As you and I are sitting down here, the president is answering Nancy Pelosi by canceling her travel. So it's like, where is this going to go? Where, you know, it's like, no, we're not going to give you, ink for your toner next. I don't know where it's going to go. So I want to talk about, because you got a really provocative piece about Trump and Russia. And this all feels like it's coming to a head. But let's start someplace else. Let's start with what you and I were talking about before we started this podcast of what's happening to the conservative movement. And you could deal with that on a number of different levels. You know, the political consequences, the intellectual consequences. But let's start with the personal consequences. What's happening to, you know, you've been a conservative. I've been a conservative for what, 40 years?
Behind you.
30 years. And the only reason there's a difference is because you're a much younger man than I am. But, we are seeing this, you're never Trump. You came out, basically said, hey, I'm totally done with the Republicans for now. Let's vote against them up and down the line.
And I hung in there probably longer than I should have, really.
No. So, I mean, imagine this. I imagine that this has affected your relationships, people you've worked with, people you had thought you were in the trenches with together.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because you say, when you ask what's happened to the conservative movement, I guess I would say, you mean what's left of the conservative movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of it does dovetail into the thing we'll talk about in a moment, I imagine, mm-hmm. which is Russia. Because the thing that I can't get my head around is the personal anger that comes out when you cannot – oh, and again, mm-hmm. I don't represent the government on that. But the personal anger that comes out when you won't share in the delusion – that had this been any other president, the Republicans would have, burned the whole city to the ground by now. That because we have to defend, or I shouldn't say we, that they have to defend this president right to the mattresses, right to the last right. berm, that you simply cannot accept things that we would have accepted as reality. And it's not a political disagreement.
See, that's the key here, is that I don't mind political disagreements. You know, we can have a different position on the flat tax or on school choice, any variety of issues. But there's something else going on
here. I miss
those. Yes, exactly. It's like, when could we actually disagree on the issues? There's something else. It's become personal.
I think it's become a matter of character. I really do. I really, this is where it does get personal and people get offended.
That's going to sound harsh.
And it does sound harsh. But, the fact of the matter is when, someone says, well, I don't see what the big deal is about all this Russia story. Well, there's only... If you're a conservative intellectual, certainly, but a lifelong Republican, you've been paying attention to the news, to say that, there are only two conclusions I can reach. One is you're either being disingenuous or there is some kind of failing here where you have really gotten to the point where you just don't care about things like Russian espionage.
Yeah.
And I don't, I can sit here and you and I bet would disagree all day long about progressive taxation and schools and all that stuff. And at the end of it, we'd still believe together, we would probably believe in things like limited government and things like that. But this really is such a break on such a personal level that
See,
it shocks me.
I get the conservatives who are transactional with Trump, who will say, look, we're going to turn a blind eye to all of the corruption and the dishonesty and all of that stuff because I want conservative judges or I want tax cuts, etc. But how does that explain the people who then actively become the defenders and the rationalizers for the Russia collusion? The people who were constantly tweeting about, really it's about the Steele dossier and anything, because that has nothing to do with
deep state.
That has nothing to do with conservative values, conservative
right.
principles. It is that whole package. But you mentioned this whole issue of character and the anger. And I've tried to figure this out, but I'm not a psychologist. I'm not really a psychologist, but it does seem that for many of these folks who, in fact, have made that transition, that there's a particular animus and anger toward those of us who have not gone along.
Well, I like Rick Wilson's expression about this. They're angry at us because every time they hear us, they experience the pain of their soul trying to reenter their body, which I think is a great line. But, you know, it is interesting. They are the angriest winners in the world. Mm-hmm. For people where everything, at least for 2 years up until the midterms came, everything was going their way. They were getting everything they wanted, and they were getting angrier and angrier and angrier. And I disagree with you about something important here, Charlie. I don't really understand the transactional republic. Because the price is too high.
Yes.
That's the problem. I mean, I would understand transactional Republicans who say, look, I can deal with a, you know, a Hillary Clinton or a, you know, President Joe Biden or whatever it is, and we're going to have to eat some stuff we don't like on taxes, and we're going to get stuff on defense. That kind of give and take, I should say, I used to be a Republican Senate staffer. Mm-hmm. I worked on the Hill. I saw that kind of transactionalism in action. But when someone says, look, I'm going to completely choke down and eat and swallow dry every word I ever said about the importance of character and leadership because I got a judge out of it, it's just not something I understand. And I think one of the interesting things, again, where this rift has developed is for a lot of these conservatives, their answer is, well, I want judges because I'm against abortion. And being against abortion excuses all other failings. It excuses everything. And there are more things that happen in the country every day than whether or not, you know, Roe v. Wade is going to be overturned, which I don't think it is.
I don't think it is either. Well, I'm pro-life as well, and I think one of the problems, of course, is long-term, are you discrediting that movement? Are you losing the cultural argument, which ultimately will decide, you know, whether or not this society continues to embrace abortion? So, I mean, I think it's a very Pyrrhic victory tactic. No, when I say that I understand them, I'm looking at it sort of on a laboratory that. I understand the process of rationalization, but it is the Faustian bargain. I agree with you completely. In the Faustian bargain, you get many good things. You get lots of things you want. You get rich. You get beautiful women. You know, you can have sex, you know, while eating burritos. You know, all kinds of good things happen. But of course, at the end, ultimately, the price is much more than you ever expected it would be. And I think that's where Republicans have found them. And as the price goes up, they're too far invested. Once you've sliced off 10% of your soul, it becomes easier to slice off the 20%. And when you're at the 40% and 50% and 60%, it's like, screw it. You know, give me the other Twinkie. You know what?
Well,
you know,
and the other problem is
I mixed that, metaphors there.
You know, the thing about the Faustian bargain is, you know, in all of those morality plays, right? You only find out at the end how you know the terrible price you've paid. This was clear right up front. I mean, there was no doubt about it. I mean, it's not
we spend a year basically saying it's freaking Mephistopheles. You understand where this is going to lead.
This is not a mystery. You know, I mean, a year before the election, we're saying, look, if you do this, here are the prices you're going to have to pay. And I think you're absolutely right about the investment, because I think the other metaphor, if we're going to drag in metaphors, this is the World War I problem of one more big offensive. If we just throw another 100,000 guys into it, you know, in the trenches, because I think every time that the people that have kind of sold out on this, and I guess I'll just say not kind of, but have sold out on this, have said, the next time I double down will be the last time. This is as bad as it gets. And, you know, people like you and people like me and others have been saying, no, this will not be the last compromise. You're going to have to double down again and again and again until there's nothing left.
Of course, they also will say that you and I are the ones who sold out. Somehow that there's this epic projection that goes on.
Yes, but we are in fact broadcasting from a yacht in the Riviera as
something
we speak.
Like that. Well, you know, explain what I understand. I mean, understand the business model now for conservative media. If you have to keep your funders happy, if you have to keep your listeners or your subscribers happy, then you're going to have to, you know, trim your sails on all of this sort of thing.
But who are the people? I mean, this is the fast, as you say, it's projection. Who are the people getting rich off of this? it's certainly not you or me. Yeah. It's people who decided I'm getting on this train, and they've done very well for themselves, especially because there's a lot of these folks who in a more meritocratic world would never have reached the kind of heights they've reached or the exposure they've had or, you know, selling the books or vitamins or exercise packages or whatever the hell they're selling. So the notion that, you know, the never Trumper folks are the ones that sold out, we're the ones that took the hit.
In what alternative reality does anyone pay attention to a Dan, you know, Bongino or something
or Seb Gorka?
Well, make all the misfit toys we could list. Okay, let's go back to this relationship thing, because this is among the things that I think the prices that we've paid are the loss of these relationships, these friendships, these partnerships, because they're hard to put back together again. You know, that these disagreements have become personal, they're hard to go back on. And I don't ever want to play the victim card here, but the big shock for me was all of the relationships that basically, you know, people you've known for 20 years or more. And yet they decided to define the relationship based on whether you're going to go along with them over the cliff of Trumpism. And if you don't, you know, they break. But also, it's like, how do you defend this? What does this say about you as a person?
I think we have to own some of it, Charlie. I'll admit it, that when someone says, you know, early on, I made a distinction between people I thought of as reluctant Trump voters who said, look, I'm taking a chance here. I can't vote for Hillary Clinton. You know, this is just an awful, you know, Election Day 2016 is the worst political day of my life, no matter what I do. I felt that way.
Yeah. Well, I didn't vote for him, but.
You know, 2 years later, I wrote a whole thing about voting for Hillary, and I felt, you know, it wasn't fun. I didn't enjoy it.
that's eating the crap sandwich.
Whichever end you start at, it's still what it is.
Right.
But 2 years later, when people say to me, hey, I really like what this guy's doing, and he fights, and he's not wrong about this, and the deep state is trying to get him, there is a part of me that says, there's something wrong with you. You know, maybe it is my fault. Maybe some of that some of us on the other side of the Trumpers, we can carry some of that water and say, I'm just uncomfortable talking to people who say, I really believe there's a caravan coming and we really need – or even worse, the people who say, I don't really believe it, but I have to use it because I'm going to monetize it and I'm going to whip up people who don't know better. I mean, either way, these are people I'm not comfortable with.
Yeah, I'm not sure who I'm more disturbed by, the people who have made the cynical decision to monetize it or those who really are the Kool-Aid drinkers who've gone off into this. Was there a breaking point for you when you decided – because it was pretty significant when you said you were going to vote down the line for Democrats, a step that I am not prepared to take. So what was your breaking point?
I think, you know, it was something rattling around, you know, in my head for a while. And I think a big breaking point for me in general with the administration was Helsinki.
Yeah.
Because I'm a Russia expert. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, something I've studied my whole life. I came of age during the Reagan years. When I saw Helsinki, I said, this is terrifying. And then I said, well, this surely will be the moment where the Republicans say, this is the party of Reagan. This is the party of American national security. We're going to step forward. And nothing happened. And I kind of held back. And really, the thing that pushed me out of the Republican Party was Susan Collins' speech about Kavanaugh, which I just thought was actually, you know, you wouldn't think that Susan Collins could make anybody mad. Mm-hmm. But it made me mad. And that's when I realized the problem is that the Republicans are in the majority and they need to be forced into the wilderness. And I said, you know, there are a lot of Republicans that I'm not going to name them because anybody I think is good, people will jump all over. But there are Republicans that I didn't want to see pushed out of Congress or out of state and local government or anywhere else. But I said, you know, when people tell you that, when the Trumpers tell you we have captured the GOP, you should believe them. And that means that until this is over, you have to vote against those folks being in the majority. I mean, you know, voting down the line, at least at the congressional level, if that meant that Devin Nunes was no longer chair of HPSE. Right? It's radio, so no one can see you wince.
But
you just right there, you'd say if that alone is what voting against all these guys did, then you'd say, well, that's probably worth it.
You know, I spent a lot of time trying to defend and rationalize and make excuses for Paul Ryan, but when it comes down to it, the fact that he left Devin Nunes in charge of that committee, that's where I do not understand that I cannot rationalize all that. So the vote this week. Speaking of like shocking new thing, the vote this
week, you haven't even said it, and I know what you're going to say.
Okay, the Senate voting. The one area where they had shown a little bit of independence from the president was on Russia, on the Russian sanctions against the oligarchs. Right before Christmas, one of the oligarchs they let him off the hook, goes back up before the Senate, and only 11 Republican senators voted consistently to keep those sanctions
in
place.
And notice who was conspicuously absent from that little rebel alliance.
I've grown used to being disappointed. I've really become accustomed to it. But the fact that Mitt Romney was not there, I mean, it's like, okay, Mitt, you wrote this really good, very, very strong op-ed. And you followed it up by what? Supporting the president on the government shutdown, and then that vote. And honestly, I've asked people, our colleagues here at the Bulwark, could you just get an explanation from them? I just want to know, why would Mitt Romney, cast that vote?
Because I don't know what's inside Mitt Romney's head or heart about this. But the same thought I had about Susan Collins, which is that they have decided that the institution of the GOP is more important than anything else. Now, at some point, it's kind of like the Shawshank Redemption,
right?
When you've been in prison your whole life, you become an institution man.
Well, how do you protect the institution of the Republican Party by aligning yourself with the Russian oligarch?
Beats me, Charlie.
Okay, so let's get right into this, the Trump-Russia thing, because this has been moving very, very quickly. I won't list all the stories that we've heard, even the FBI investigation into whether he was a Russian asset, the really appalling story about how we have no idea what his private conversations with Vladimir Putin are, the fact that he asked for the notes from the translator, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You had a piece in USA Today a couple of days ago. I will tell you, I don't think anybody has any doubt about where I stand on Donald Trump, but I have been trying to rationalize, is there a simpler explanation, the Hanlon's razor explanation, don't attribute to malice what can be explained by stupidity. Mm-hmm. Are we just talking about a really ignorant, naive, vain man? Or is there something else going on here? And I came to the conclusion that doesn't work anymore. Hanlon's razor does not cut this one. So tell me, where do you think we are at now with Trump-Russia?
To get to innocent explanations, you really have to expend a huge amount of calories on a willing suspension of disbelief.
And I've tried and failed.
The problem is that we're having a very dumb binary argument about this that is in part being framed by Trump supporters as either everything's okay or you're accusing the president of being, like a Russian deep mole, who gets his orders by hypnotic telephone suggestions.
John Le Carre.
That's dumb because that's not how the real world works. What I suspect, and this is, again, just kind of 30 years of being a Russia watcher, Donald Trump's been to Russia many times. He's done many deals with the Russians. His finances are entangled, at least from what we can tell. His finances are deeply entangled with the Russian mob, the Russian intelligence services, the Russian government. And as I say in that piece, those are all the same people. The mob, the government, mm-hmm. the intelligence services are all the same Russians. I think what he's doing and what his concern is, he is proactively trying not to piss off Vladimir Putin. I don't think the Russians call him up and say, Donald, dissolve NATO. I think that the president says, I know I've done all these things. I think in the president's head, he says, look, I know I've done all these bad things. I know I've got all this paper trail that's all over, the East Coast from New York to New Jersey. And I know the Russians know it. So I'm going to be very careful. I am not going to do anything that ever pisses off Putin. Now, the president's supporters will say, but look at what he's doing. Look at the administration's
policy. He's really been tough on him.
The problem is that the president, and I think this is a dysfunctional aspect of this administration that people don't think about enough, the president and the administration are not the same people.
Right.
That the administration, that the kind of lifetime, assistant secretaries and bureaucrats and diplomats and intelligence people, they've had a very consistent policy on Russia that's been the same policy for, 50 years. The president has his own policies on Russia that kind of are tweeted out that are all organized around saying to Vladimir Putin, please don't be angry with me.
But the lack of subtlety, you would think that with all of this focus on him, that even the Russians would say, could you at least like not be so obvious?
Well, that's one of the reasons I don't think that he is deeply, you know, the people who keep getting out there and saying he's a red president or a Manchurian candidate.
No Manchurian candidate.
No, the Russians are too smart to ever get that deep in with somebody who is, you know, like Donald Trump. I mean, because I think Trump is so impulsive and, you know,
unreliable
that anything that he knows about Russia, everybody's going to know sooner or later. I think it's much more subtle than
that. Okay, so let's drill down on all of this. Part of this is his very clear admiration for Vladimir Putin, what he represents.
Or his fear of him.
Well, okay, let's talk about what Donald Trump thinks about Vladimir Putin. He does have a thing for authoritarians,
yes,
for, the Ubermensch.
Yeah.
But he's also afraid of, so what is he afraid of?
If you displease me, I will leak stuff into the international intelligence environment.
What does he have to leak?
Money laundering.
Yeah.
I think that's number one. And again, I'm guessing here based on, you know, what Russians have been doing in New York for 30
years. It's not the P tape. It's the money.
See, as I said in the piece, you know, the president's opponents have really lured, you know, it seems to me almost impossible to embarrass this president about sex.
The P tape might come close.
It might come close.
By the way, I'm not a believer in the P tape.
Yeah, so. I just don't think it's there. But I also think that as our political situation gets worse, the Russians are going to start injecting stuff into the public sphere, because what their goal is to hurt our democracy. They are not there. They don't care about helping or hurting Donald Trump. As things get worse, they're going to try and just inject more octane right into that chaos machine.
The return on investment. Vladimir
Huge.
Putin's ROI is like the greatest ever.
Yeah.
Whatever he did to damage the democracy, because we're not even...
It's like buying Microsoft for a buck.
Absolutely, because you don't even feel like you're halfway through the payoff of all of this. The money laundering, so what do we know about the money laundering?
Well, you know, I think the better question is, what does the Southern District of New York know about the money laundering? But I mean,
which, by the way, is important because it's not the Mueller investigation.
Right. It's not going to go away.
Even when the Mueller investigation wraps up, that is ongoing.
Right.
And I'm guessing he's more afraid of that.
Right.
In many ways.
I mean, leaving the Donald Trump out of it, if you said to me there is a, you know, very wealthy New York real estate mogul who does a lot of business with the Russians
in cash,
building stuff in cash from New York to Florida, without any partisan leaning, my initial reaction is going to be, well, of course they are. That's how the Russians launder their money.
Right.
So that my first reaction is to say, well, of course that's happening. And I think one thing that's important for people to understand, because, again, this gets lost in the, is he a Russian spy or is he just an innocent victim? I think a lot of this stuff happened from Mike Flynn right up to the president. It all happened because nobody really thought he was going to win.
Right.
They weren't prepared for this.
Including himself.
Including him. And I think they didn't clean up their conflicts of interest. They didn't kind of cover their financial tracks. They didn't get their finances in order the way real people do when they say, hey, I think I'm about to go to work in Washington. Maybe I ought to make sure, you know, that my bank statements look right and all that stuff.
His business was never transparent. It was never accountable. So, I mean, you had decades and decades of practices figuring nobody will ever see, nobody will ever find out. His taxes, I think, are just the tip of the iceberg. I don't know what we learned from the taxes, but Donald Trump basically thinks of all of that stuff as stuff that is never going to be seen by anybody, much less like really, really smart people who work for the Justice Department.
Well, and of course, because the president doesn't think there's anybody smarter than he is. Mm. And I mean, this really is not the varsity team here. One of the things I found really striking about the opening chapters of Bob Woodward's book is they're telling him, now, if you want to run for president, you're going to have to fix your opinion about abortion, and you're going to have to fix the fact that you donated to Democrats. I kind of wondered, who was the guy who sat down and said, you're going to have to fix
everything.
All of the things you've ever done for the past 35 years, if you really think you're going to win the presidency.
But he's brazened his way through so many things. I mean, he's tested all of those limits and those norms. You know, how many things did he do, or we learned about him, that would have destroyed the political career of anyone else in American politics? And at a certain point, that will breed a certain amount of arrogance, a certain amount of, you know, that the rules do not apply to me. So there must be something that he is still afraid of.
Well, this is the part where we come right back to where we began with this conversation, which is that his – I don't even call them supporters. I mean, at this point, the people we're talking about are the president's enablers, where they are purposely turning away from things where they would have been the people to destroy a president's career or a candidate's chances over these issues. Our colleagues on the right would have been the people to say, you can't do the things he's done. You can't attack veterans. You can't be paying off porn stars. You can't be in bed with the Russians, you know, on and on and on. And so part of the way he's gotten away with it is I think a lot of our colleagues on the right have convinced themselves that if they don't defend Donald Trump, there will be this leftist apocalypse.
Right.
And that's the story they tell themselves.
But, you know, not to normalize this. That all of these attacks on the investigation seem to suggest that we don't want to find out what the truth is.
Yes.
Because we don't actually care that if the president was engaging in corrupt deals with the Russians or that he was complicit in this attack on our democracy with the Russians, that we're okay with it as long as we get the conservative judges, which is really breathtaking.
It is. It's, and this is where I just am, you know, I'm uncomfortable talking to people like that. I mean, at some point, you know, it used to be, I said to a friend of mine the other day, you know, a fellow still Republican here in D.C., I said, you know, it used to be the gravest insult to ever question the patriotism of another American.
Right.
That was something I never did. It was something we were taught, you know, as young men and women on either side. You just didn't go there. I find that I don't get through the day now without questioning the patriotism of a half a dozen people. I mean, it just really strikes me.
So in fairness, though, do these people, and we know who we're talking about, do they actually not believe these allegations, which is defensible, or have they decided that even if true, they're going to stick with him?
I always think of a line from Kurt Vonnegut's book, Mother Night, where he says, we have to be careful what we pretend. We are what we pretend to be, so we have to be careful what we pretend to be. Mm. I think part of the problem is that if you've told yourself this stuff over and over again for the past 2 years, it may be that initially you said, you know, I've got to kind of wave off some of this stuff because I want tax cuts and I want you. It may be 2 years in, people are saying, I have just convinced myself of this because otherwise I can't shave the guy in the mirror. I think some of them genuinely believe it and have talked themselves into it. But I think many more of them, because you and I both know a lot of these folks to be highly intelligent people, to be people of great probity and incisiveness. And I think they're saying, I am going to clench my teeth and tough it out because whatever comes after Trump will be worse.
Well, you know, it's Bill Kristol had a very intriguing tweet the other day where he said that business people that he has been talking with are starting to question their allegiance to Trump based on what's happening with the economy, the trade war, the government shutdown. But at the same moment, you have this intellectual class, this Trumpian, and I'm doing the air quotes, Trumpian intellectuals who seem to be doubling down. And that's a fascinating phenomenon of intellectuals basically turning their talents into the defense or the deflection of information about what's going on here.
Well, where do they go when it's over?
Yeah.
You know, as a friend of mine who worked in conservative media for a lot of years here in D.C. said, you know, once you've committed and you've doubled down enough times on Trumpism, you don't have a road back. And I think what some of these conservatives are doing is prepping the ground. I think there's two things going on. One is they're prepping the ground to say, look, when Trump goes down and this whole thing implodes like the Hindenburg, we can say, when we finally have to turn and say, well, we finally have to abandon the president, we can at least turn to the president's supporters and say, look, we gave him every chance. Mm-hmm. We defended him as best we could.
Right. We did not stab him in the back.
We didn't stab him. Exactly. Yeah. We didn't stab him in the back. And now we can walk away with a clear conscience. I think the other thing is, for some of these folks, they're trying to preserve that market. I mean, when Trump's gone, there's still going to be a kind of Trumpist market of, you know, 30% of the people that they want to get to.
People should put a pin in what you just said, because I think that's exactly right, to be able to say that, you know, that I wasn't one of the people that bailed on him. Because there is this culture in Trumpism where Donald Trump cannot fail. He can only be betrayed.
Right.
And he can only be stabbed in the back, which, of course, you know, for, you know, students of history, you know, the consequence that you know, the stab in the back, you know, after World War One. I always make these references, and then I find out that only like guys like you know what I'm talking about, you know. But the long consequence. I mean, that became the rationale for the rise of the Third.
1918 led to 1939.
Exactly, and so it's certainly possible that you know, Trump could go down in a spectacular way, and a huge portion of the right will believe in the stab in the back theory, and that this will become the legend. This will become the narrative.
Some of those conservative intellectual enablers that Bill Kristol was talking about want to be able to turn to those conservatives and say, "It wasn't me. I didn't do. You know, I was here till the end. And when I finally had to walk." You know, these are the people, you know, like in 1974 to
right.
say, hey, I was with you, Mr. President, right up until, you know, August 1st.
And many of them were able to stay viable.
Although, interestingly enough, and I think this is why some of our conservative colleagues are toughing it out this way, there were a lot of people who never worked again in Washington right. after 1974 because they had doubled down too many times. And they were, aside from the people who went to jail, I mean, there were just people whose credibility was gone after years of defending Nixon.
So I've been thinking about writing about this, and I may write about this, but there was a congressman named Charles Wiggins, who was on the House Judiciary Committee, and he was Richard Nixon's biggest defender. He was a smart guy. He eventually went on to become an appeals court judge, but he was the number one defender of Richard Nixon right to the bitter end, until the day they released the transcript of the smoking gun tape, and the White House invited him, you know, as the number one pro Nixon guy, to the White House to read the transcript of this tape before it was released. He read it. And Charles Wiggins said, "That's it. I'm out. This is awful. I am going to vote for the articles of impeachment." And this is one of the rarest things in American politics, certainly rare now, for someone to look at the evidence and change their mind fundamentally and change what they do. And the question is, when something comes out about Donald Trump, are there any – you're
shaking
your head.
My head already.
I agree with you. Are there any more guys like Charles Wiggins now in 2019? And I doubt it.
Well, the problem is this. You know, let's say the Mueller report is every bit as horrific as the president's opponents think it. I don't think it will be. I think the Mueller report is going to be mostly horrific if you're a forensic accountant. But let's say the Mueller report says something really startling that a Wiggins Republican would say, "Oh my God, this is it. I'm out." The problem is that the Republicans have concentrated so much of the Trump base in their primary vote that there are a lot of guys who know that no matter what, I mean, you could come out with a tape of Donald Trump speaking Russian and selling the continuity of government plan over the phone, and there are going to be a bunch of people in these hyper-red districts who are going to say, "I just don't believe it."
Yeah.
Because the president's prepped the ground for 2 years to say, "Don't believe whatever comes out."
Yeah, that creation of that alternative reality, I think, fundamentally changes our politics.
It changes everything.
And that's not going to go away when Donald Trump leaves office.
No, and I think that a lot of the guys, especially in at the House level, are going to be left saying, you know, my base believes that Donald Trump was set up during, you know, pillow talk by some FBI agents, and that all of this is falsified evidence in a way that Nixon never did, to his credit. You know, yes, I think, you know, I did a piece in The Atlantic where I said, I remember those "I don't believe the New York Times" bumper stickers. I'm sure you remember those as
absolutely,
well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, sure.
But, I mean, if that was the worst it ever got, is that people said, "I don't believe the New York Times," that's nothing compared to what's going on
nothing.
Now.
No, we didn't even get to, I think you written another piece about the relationship between Donald Trump and the military. I was thinking a couple of weeks ago, but we've done this so many times, that, you know, the break with the generals, the loss of General Mattis, that was going to be a real turning point, because that was, you know, it's one thing for Donald Trump to attack guys like you and me, but when you start having the generals saying these things, that's the kind of thing that, because you can't really impugn their patriotism.
It's deeply unhealthy.
It is deeply unhealthy, and yet here we are. Hey, Tom, I wish we had more time to talk. You and I could do this almost endlessly. Next time you're back in D.C., well, I don't actually live here, but, you know, let's do this again, okay?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Charlie.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back.